This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Cup of Dreams and the other cup special. Manchester United look all set for the Carabao Cup final. Rashford's flying form, Weghorst gets it launched and Fernandes finishes it all off. It's the fourth round of the FA Cup this weekend. Manchester City versus Arsenal, the big one, and then plenty of banana skin potential for Leicester, Leeds, Spurs, West Ham, amongst others. Also today, fury over the top 100 players in the world. Idle transfer chat. Hopefully we won't have time to bring you Nations League expansion news. You've asked lots of questions and the most uncomfortable listener award is unveiled. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, Jonathan Faduba.
Good day.
And hello, Mark Langdon from the Racing Post.
Hi, Max.
Just to say, I am broadcasting from the garden. So if you hear birds tweeting, dogs barking, etc., that is why. Is it the choice of this or a screaming baby? This seemed like the more sensible approach, Barry.
Well, yeah, I was listening on Monday's pod, I think it was, out for my walk, and I could hear wildlife in the background, and I presumed it was Australian wildlife. It seemed like it could have been a galah of some other kind
of dingo,
tropical bird.
I got told off for actually calling a koala bear. Someone says, has my citizenship been revoked? But as currently, not yet. Anyway, let's get on with the football. That's vaguely why we're here. Nottingham Forest 0, Manchester United 3. So barring something utterly ridiculous, Manchester United are into the Carabao Cup final. What did you make of this, Mark?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to next week's second leg. I thought that Manchester United did sort of what you'd expect them to do and played well. They got the early goal, fully deserved that lead. Some of their football was exciting. You know, Anthony, the finishing touch, not quite there, but actually was involved in a lot of the good play. Eriksen, I thought, dictated the game in the second half. Rashford scored. A great goal from Manchester United's point of view. I think you can look at Forest's defending for that goal and start to question it. Weghorst is off the mark and again was involved linking up the play. And barring a kind of 10-15 minute spell when Forest got what they felt was the equaliser, it was a controlled performance. And the City Ground's not been, without going into cliche territory, not been an easy place for the big teams to go this season. Tottenham got knocked out by Forest. Liverpool slipped up. Chelsea didn't win there. So, Forest had been doing well. United were coming off the back of a disappointing result against Arsenal. And, that they now look like they're reaching a final under Erik ten Hag, and it just continues that progression. So I thought it was a really good night for them.
Atravatis, at what point do we say Rashford should be spending less time pissing about scoring goals and more time focusing on feeding the kids? He looks, I don't know if this is the best Marcus Rashford had ever looked, Jonathan, but he seems to have all the things that he had when he was good the first time and has sort of added a sort of physical power that I don't know if he'd have even tried to score that goal in his first incarnation of being good.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever looked this good, to be honest. The transformation that he's gone under in the last year is remarkable. And I don't know if it's kind of like a testament to Erik ten Hag's management or if it's just genuinely the penny's dropped and he's kind of turned mid-20s and is now sort of everything's just clicking into gear. Obviously, he had a full pre-season, didn't he? And that was quite important in terms of, getting his fitness once the new manager was announced. There was a lot of Instagram posts of him doing sort of extra sessions and stuff like that, double sessions. And I don't know if it's just that kind of focus that's come in. Also, I know that there's been off the field stuff. He talked about it during the World Cup, didn't he? Sort of personal issues maybe that may have affected him. And you never sort of really know, do you, the mindset of a player and what they're going through at times and how that can affect their form. And sometimes we judge players without really knowing, obviously, things that might be going on in their personal lives. But he just looks in unbelievable form. I mean, Ten Hag has somehow managed to turn him into sort of this sort of quasi-English Mbappe where he is picking the ball up on the halfway line and beating three players and cutting inside. And that goal, the thing that sort of struck me about it is he kind of just bullied the Forest defenders. And Rashford in the last sort of 18 months, I've been fairly critical of him in terms of his play because I felt that when he was playing sort of under previous managers, he was kind of getting in the team just almost on name alone, really. He was that sort of lackluster. But he's really, you know, I think in his last 10 goals in his last sort of since the World Cup, roughly, and 2 assists. And he's just flying in every single game. He looks like he's going to score. I think Crystal Palace is one of the only games he hasn't scored in. You can't really praise him enough. It just shows that maybe under a manager who knows what they're doing, you know, there was that disciplinary issue, wasn't there, against Wolves, where he kind of overslept and was on the naughty step for 45 minutes, came on and scored, and then scored one of the winning goals. So everything's just clicking into gear for him. And I'm really happy for him because it seems like he's a really dedicated player. Maybe, I don't know if there's a contract, maybe incentive there as well. Just obviously final year is contract. There's an option to extend, but whatever it is, he's just transformed. And I think I do lean towards thinking it's a lot to do with Ten Hag, because you also look at players like Luke Shaw, for example. Shaw looks like he's lost weight. He's in incredible form this season. Players who just looked substandard in the last 2 years suddenly look really lean and fit and hungry. So I do think it is a lot to do with Ten Hag, but you also have to praise Rashford for that sort of dedication and the will to improve his game.
Ed writes, how many vouts, vout of Veghorst, vout if a Veghorst, vout chop vout? He kind of works, Barry. I think he scored his goal. I did wonder, I know this isn't about Ronaldo, but you know, Ten Hag wanted to get rid of Ronaldo. I wonder what he's thinking about Wout Weghorst being the man to fill his boots.
I would say he probably thinks Wout Weghorst isn't fit to clean his boots, let alone fill them. But Wout is there now. And it was, you know, decent poacher's goal. Look, we all know Manchester United are clearly a better team than Forest, but all three of the goals Manchester United scored last night were extremely avoidable from a Forest point of view, quite sloppy. The first one was terrible. I thought the third one was terrible. And Wayne Hennessy, you could say, was at fault for the second one, but Casemiro played the ball to Anthony after beating someone in midfield. I didn't see who it was. Anthony's shot was saved by Hennessy, but he parried the ball straight into the path of Weghorst, who reacted quicker than Scott McKenna and fired into the net. It's probably a big moment for him, his first goal for Manchester United. He wants to hit the ground running, and I suppose he has done that now. And good for him. I imagine he will be a good signing for Manchester United. Erik ten Hag clearly knows him and rates him. He seems like a nice fella to have around, and I wouldn't expect him to score 12, 15 goals in the second half of the season, but if he chips in with 6 or 7 and just contributes, which I fully expect him to do, he'll be an astute loan signing.
Yeah, and he links the play, Mark, doesn't he? I mean, that's his job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was one sort of triangle of passing where I think Anthony eventually had the shot, and it was an unfortunate moment because it felt like that deserved a goal, actually. It was really, nicely worked. And I think at least with Weghorst, then you can argue about his overall ability. But Ten Hag has got, when they signed him, they had a plan for what he was going to bring to the team. And I think there have maybe been signings previously at Manchester United that there hasn't necessarily been a plan. And it has been about, is this person a big name? Is he going to do the social media hits? And, you know, well, let's bring him in and see how he fits into the team. But, you know, Weghorst is never going to, you know, sprint away from defenders, but he will be that kind of wall that you can pass the ball into, bring the attacking players that United have got. And I also think that, you know, because he hasn't got pace, you know, you don't want crosses going into him. You maybe defend a bit higher up the pitch, and then that create space for other players, somebody like Rashford, to go in behind. And you know, with Ten Hag, and I agree with Jonathan just with what Ten Hag has managed to do, really, because you know, when he makes his substitutions, you can see what he's trying to do, and it's not always going to work out. And you know, he brought Fred on Sunday, and they didn't manage to really sort of shut Saka down, but you know, he's used Fred in, you know, very tactical ways this season. And I think when players can understand sort of those decisions and can see it working more often than not, then they go along with it. So I think it was another sort of successful night for Ten Hag in that he's managed to bring in Weghorst, and he scored the goal, and he's played quite well as well. So yeah, you know, this is a big competition, I think, for Manchester United, because It's been a while since they won a trophy by their own standards. So if they could get the League Cup in Ten Hag's first season, I think it just adds to those building blocks of what he's trying to do.
One thing I did notice was that in his goal celebration, Wout Weghorst bore a striking resemblance to Tommy Lee Royce, the multiple murderer from the drama Happy Valley, which he's a psychopath and a nasty.
I'm glad it was a fictional murderer. I didn't know where you were going.
Yeah, clearly you're not on board the Happy Valley bandwagon.
Well, no, Max. I mean I've got it good to go.
Yeah, I'd get on board that. It's very good.
Yeah, it's a great series, but I'm still on Death in Paradise at the moment. Jonathan?
Well, I just think, I mean, while I agree with Mark and I kind of agree about Weghorst in general, it could be a good signing. It could be an interesting move. I do think that if you look at the wider context of it and sort of going back to the weekend and looking at where Arsenal are and other teams, I do feel like, are we all kind of ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the fact that Manchester United pretty much have no money and are sort of shopping around in the Turkish league, trying to find bargain bucket signings to kind of get through the season when they're one of the richest clubs in the world. I mean, I know there's the context behind it, which is obviously they're actively looking to either sell the club, the owners, or kind of find new investment. There seems to be a lot of talk about Weghorst as if it's like a shrewd deal, where I'm not really sure it is. I think it's just the fact that Ten Hag probably said, I need a forward to be able to get us anywhere near the top four. And they've gone, well, here's your budget of about £1 million to get a loan signing and do what you can. And sort of Wout Weghorst has come up. I know he had a decent spell in Turkey, 9 goals, I think, in 18 games, and obviously 2 in 20 for Burnley. But I don't know if it's like a Henrik Larsson signing of the Ferguson days, where, you know, he comes in January and it's this sort of a masterstroke, or is it...
So why don't they have any money? Where's that? What's going on there?
Well, I think they've hired... people, I think, is it the Rain Group? I'm not sure, but they've hired people to kind of look into a takeover of the club. And it feels to me as if they've kind of put the you know, spending on the back burner and kind of decided not to go for it. But I just wonder if this is ultimately going to cost United further down the line, because if you look at the amount of games coming up and the squad, you know, Martial's constantly injured. Weghorst is kind of open to question. I think his hold-up play is decent, but if you look at sort of Chelsea and, you know, Liverpool sort of splashing 40 million on Gakpo and others, United aren't really looking at the longer term, bigger picture here, are they? It's kind of like a plug the hole while you can for a few months type signing. And I just want, I mean,
poor old Val. Yeah. He's plugging the hole. He's in the bargain bucket. He's just scored a goal. He's just having a good time. Hope he's not listening. Yesterday is the first day I learned that Brennan Johnson was the son of David Johnson, the Nottingham Forest striker. I was not aware of that. But, you know, Johnson and Gibbs White look good together. Forest, I don't know if they'll be okay, but like getting to the semi-final is no bad thing. Luke, what's the point of two-leg semi-finals in the other cup? Shell out another £50 on tickets for a game. We're now starting 3-0 down. Jim got in touch to say until the 2016 edition of the Copa do Brasil, in the first two rounds, which were two-legged ties, if the away team won the first leg by two or more goals, they'd progress straight through to the next round without needing to play the second leg, which they would play at home. However, the second leg would still have to be played if the home team won the first leg by two or more goals. So had we had the 2016 Copa do Brasil rules yesterday, United would be through. It does feel like, Barry, with just the amount of fixtures, the second leg of the Carabao Cup semi-final could be won. We could all let that go and probably be okay.
I don't see the point of it, Max. I genuinely, even if there wasn't fixture congestion, I fail to see what the point of it is.
Oh, I'm in full agreement. Thomas says, following your conversation on shirt sponsors of rivals, when an Aston Villa fan wouldn't have his car windscreen fixed by an auto windscreens repairman despite being in the pissing rain for an hour with his family. As a Notts County fan, looking at Forest shirt early this season with glee, no sponsor, small-time club, all that. Imagine how I feel now, having to hate on a refugee charity. Being a football fan is hard. Thank you, Thomas. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll look ahead to the fourth round of the FA Cup.
Oh.
Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly FA Cup preview. So, look, Arsenal go to Manchester City tomorrow night, 8 p.m. kickoff. Barry, this is the tie of the round. I confidently state.
Yes, it is. So we've, I think, 11 Premier League sides left, 13 Championship, 4 League One, 3 League Two, and 1 from the Conference. That's the makeup of the final 32. You would be astonished at how long it took me to figure that out, despite having a list of the fixtures written down in front of me. I got it wrong so often. I'm still not confident that that I have it right, but that's what I make it anyway. And yes, Man City Arsenal is the one that sticks out like a sore thumb, even though I guess both managers won't be taking it as seriously as they would if it was a league match. We might see weakened sides insofar as either of them are capable of fielding a weakened side, but we do know Man City have far more strength and depth than Arsenal. Also, the fact it's the first time they've met this season, we're all looking forward to their league meetings, obviously, because of their league positions, but it's a really tricky one to call, and until I see the lineups that both managers pick, I wouldn't have a notion who'll win this game.
Mm. And I wonder, Mark, if it has any bearing on it doesn't have any bearing on the Premier League. It's a different competition. Or does it? I don't know.
I'm sure that on Monday's pod, probably spend 20 minutes talking about what it means for the Premier League. And I was wondering here with Arteta, like, you know, if you play your full strength team and you win, then what a massive boost that would be. You know, you're showing everybody, and I think the general consensus is that obviously City are trailing. They've got to play Arsenal twice. They can win those two games and get back within striking distance. If you win that game, you know, does it show and prove that, you know, you are capable of actually, you know, winning those games against Manchester City and taking the title away from them? If you play your best team and lose, does that start to bring about self-doubt in the team? I'm not so sure. I think that it'll be a mix and match team probably from both. And, you know, from Arsenal's point of view, they've not really been able to, have chosen not to play sort of anybody outside of their normal team really in recent weeks because, you know, they've had no injuries. And from Arteta's point of view, you'd want to keep the whole squad involved, I would have thought, at some stage. They're not even playing in the next round of the Europa League, are they? So they've not even got those moments. So could be an opportunity for them to rotate. But I just think the way that Arsenal are playing, you know, they should show no fear to Manchester City. They've had some bad defeats there in the past, but this is a completely different Arsenal team. And I mean, whatever side Arteta picks is capable of troubling City. The other thing is that about that first league meeting was I didn't realise when it was. The same night as the Champions League action. So you've got to choose between Arsenal City and Borussia Dortmund Chelsea or Club Brugge against Benfica. That had sort of crept up on me until yesterday.
I'm working that night. I'm going to have to pretend, you know, just have it on another tiny screen. A bit like when I'm watching Cambridge games on iFollow and everyone's looking at me going, what on earth are you doing here? Interestingly, Jonathan, is that because a lot of Premier League teams are out, right, it is a real opportunity for those sides left in. The FA Cup is it's not easy to win now because at some point you will come up against one of the best. But, I sort of feel it's worth both those sides gambling to get through by playing a full strength team.
Well, the big sides kind of take it the most serious. Probably looks like they've got a decent chance of going quite far. If you look at some of the fixtures, you know, you've got sort of Accrington, Leeds, Bristol City, West Brom, Fulham, Sunderland. There's not a huge amount of kind of, like you'd maybe say, marquee names in there. Sheffield Wednesday, Fleetwood. So there is an opportunity. Obviously, Brighton, Liverpool are playing as well. So there is a chance. I mean, I think on what Mark said, in terms of Arsenal and Man City, they've not played each other for like more than a calendar year, which is quite rare in Premier League terms and, you know, in general, really. So in terms of the importance of it, I do actually think that there is a marker to be laid down. And I feel like as if, you know, the last time Arsenal played Man City away, they lost 5-0, obviously. And then there was that the game at the Emirates where there was that late Rodri sort of winner in the 90th minute. So I do feel like even though it is just the cup and there probably will be a lot of rotation, because City are playing Arsenal so late in the season, the second game, it almost does feel like the first game of the Premier League, if that makes sense, in a weird way, because they can be so far ahead by the time they play the second game or even the first game in February. So I do think there is that importance. But you're right. In when you look at the fixtures, there's a real opportunity for someone, maybe even someone like Brighton. You know, they beat Liverpool 3-0 in the league not long ago. If they can get through that game, potentially you could be looking at it just in the way that Newcastle have sort of got one foot in the final in the League Cup. So a team that wants to win something, and I always find it strange how a lot of more like lower down the league, mid-table teams kind of seem to dismiss the cup and rest players when there's a real opportunity to do sort of maybe a Leicester and win a cup like they did a few years ago. So I'd like to think that someone will take it seriously to try and give some importance to their fans. But as you know, like most of the teams tend to rotate these days, don't they, in the cup.
And Barry, where do you see the upsets? You've got Walsall, Leicester, Accrington, Leeds, Preston, Spurs, Reading going to Manchester United, West Ham having to go to Derby County.
I'm just looking at the remaining 32 teams. I think in 16 years of doing this podcast, I'm struggling to think of a single thing of note that either Preston or Walsall have done, for good or bad. So I'm imploring them to...
Are you saying Preston in their entire history or in the last 16 years?
No, in the last 16 years. I can't remember us ever sort of discussing anything to do with Preston or Walsall, whether it's something good they've done or something bad that's happened to them. So I'm imploring them to earn themselves some a sizable amount of Monday morning coverage by beating either Spurs are away at Preston and Leicester are away at Walsall. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Wrexham beat Sheffield United, although you wonder, I mean, and this sounds ridiculous, I think they will take it seriously, they have to, but Wrexham are in a three-way race to get out of the National League. Only one team goes up automatically. I saw a stat somewhere recently that the top three teams in the National League are all on course to get 100 points, and at least one of them won't get promoted. So, I wouldn't be surprised if Wrexham beat Sheffield United, assuming they put out a full-strength team. I could see Derby County beating West Ham. There's no other standout. I reckon Sunderland might beat Fulham. I was hoping to go to that game, but I can't because I have to work and I can't get out of it. So I'm going for Wrexham, Preston and Walsall.
Producer Joel says he can't believe Barry doesn't remember Walsall finishing runners-up in the 2015 Johnson's Paint Trophy.
And Preston had 5-0 in their first six league matches this season. A remarkable feat.
And we did comment on it, I think, so yeah. Over to you, Walsall.
When did David Beckham play for Preston? And did Football Weekly exist then? No. So and presumably Tom Finney was not playing for Preston when Football Weekly began. But listen, if you have interesting information about Preston or Walsall from the last 16 years, then Football Weekly at TheGuardian.com. Now, The Guardian is ranking the top 100 footballers in the world in 2022. Me and Barry were on the voting committee, so were many other experts, so it wasn't just us. And I'm furious about it, as everyone should be furious about it. We've released numbers 100 to 41. The first big problem is that it counts up and not down. So when you get to the website, it starts with 41 and then you scroll down to 100. I have actually emailed football editor Marcus Christensen to say that is not how a countdown should be. A countdown, it's not. Bruno Brooks can't go up, can he? He has to go down for his countdown. The biggest shock, possibly Ronaldo at number 51, but I didn't have him in my top 40 in the world this year. I don't think he's in the top 40 in the world.
Are you saying it's a shock that he's as low as 51, or that it's a shock he's there at all? I was surprised
he's there.
Yeah. Me too. I didn't have him in my top 40. Well, I mean, the comments under this are always a delight. People get very angry about the list, these experts and so-called experts, which I include myself among, is not the same as the list they would have done. And they get furious about it. I did notice a comment from long time below the line contributor, Massive Bum Wizard 4545. I stopped reading after I saw you put Alexander Mitrovic ahead of Rafael Varane, Frankie de Jong, Manuel Neuer, Declan Rice, and Deo Upamecano. To which Bruce Medallion replied, so you stopped reading because your list is different to this list. And then another commenter whose name I didn't get was, these lists are to get you to click. And you go, well, yes, of course they are. Football editor Marcus Christensen didn't get in touch with, you know, approximately 200 different journalists, former players, pundits, etc. and so on, and then lovingly compiled this list in conjunction with the graphics department. I mean, the amount of work that goes into this is incredible, just to hide it away in a corner of the website and hope no one would look at it.
Was there anyone on this list, Mark, or that you were surprised to see? Anyone that got you infuriated?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go down the Bum Wizard 4545 route too much, but I mean, it did feel...
Massive Bum Wizard.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I suppose when I was looking at the list, it felt potentially that the World Cup had played quite a big part, and I was sort of wondering if it had been compiled sort of just after the World Cup or even during the World Cup.
It was compiled just after the World Cup, and I do take your point, and a lot of other people have made that point, but I would argue that the World Cup should play a massive part in it.
Yeah, maybe. I suppose, you know, I mean, Livakovic is somebody that probably wouldn't have been in the top probably 200, like 2 weeks before the World Cup. And he did have a great one. And Otamendi making, I always look at the 100 for some reason, sort of, it's the one at 100 that I always get attracted to, probably more than who's number sort of one or two. And Otamendi sneaking into the top 100. I think he's another one that maybe there was a World Cup bias. But I mean, it's an impossible job I'm sure you've sort of worked out before.
Yeah. I mean, I've got so much recency bias. I was furious that Hugo Lloris is the 76th best player in the world because he made a mistake last week or whatever after the vote was done.
Well, I had Leo Messi in as my number one, which was entirely influenced by the World Cup, because if he hadn't won the World Cup, I'd probably have... he would have been in my top five, probably, but he wouldn't have been number one. But him winning, ending the year by winning the World Cup, and it's based on a calendar year, not on previous achievements, not on a season. It's based on the calendar year of 2022. So that is probably what nudged me to have him ahead of Kylian Mbappe and Erling Haaland, who were my 2-3.
That was it. I did my top list and then I'd realised I'd left out Erling Haaland. So I had to stick him in quite high up. Any furious thoughts, Jonathan?
No, no Bum Wizard sort of fury. Maybe just it did raise an eyebrow when I saw Mitrovic above Rodrigo. But as you just mentioned, there, it's kind of based on the calendar year, and I suppose I think people tend to get triggered by these lists because it says best players in the world. They sort of assume that this means that player is better than this player, rather than maybe the less sort of headline grabbing best performing players in the world, maybe list, if you know what I mean. So I think that is what gets Bum Wizards around the world really upset. But no, to be fair, a lot of it so far is pretty fair.
I had Ashraf Hakimi in sixth, and I based that on the fact that he had a brilliant Africa Cup of Nations, he had a brilliant World Cup, and he was good in between, which suggests to me I possibly had him too low.
Yeah, I mean, I there was one bit of the World Cup, I think sort of halfway down the list, it's just like the whole Morocco team. Bang! I was like, everyone's just gone, ding, ding. Oh, I've got to chuck all of them in. Anyway, you can go and find it. And then I think the top 40 are released pretty soon. And then you can be furious about that bit of the list as well.
I'm expecting Wout Weghorst in somewhere in that top 40, I guess. Absolutely. I don't think he's popped up yet.
He should be. The 100 best players in the women's game have been revealed. A few lionesses in the top 10. Beth Mead is at 2. Kira Walsh 9, Lucy Bronze 10, Alexia Putellas is number 1, Sam Kerr at 3, and that'll do for part 2. Part 3, we'll do some transfer gossip and take your questions. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Great news, more football. The Nations League is expanding, Barry. It's just what we wanted.
Well, it is expanding, but apparently there won't be more football. It'll be the same amount of football, just different football spread across the Nations League and the Euro and 2026 World Cup and 2028 Euros. I don't want to sound like I'm better than everyone else, but I know for a fact I'm the only person who drinks in my local pub that understands the Nations League format and knows what it is. Right? I know this to be a fact. And I think I'm generally, if you got 100 football fans together, I would be one of a handful who understands the format of the Nations League. And I was reading about this new expanded format, which introduces quarterfinals and promotional playoffs for various groups. I lost the will to live about two sentences in. It doesn't come into place till September 2024, so I just suggest we put it to one side and get back to it in 2 years if we're still here.
Okay, that sounds great. Anthony Gordon. Adam says, 60 million for Anthony Gordon. Has the world gone stark raving mad? Thank you. The best bit of this was Charlie pointed us in the direction of a tweet from EFC Daily, which read, Everton will give the green light for Anthony Gordon to join Newcastle today. The wide man took the advice of fellow professional Ross Barkley, who told him that London as a city is a distraction amid links with Chelsea this window. The bright lights of London loom large for Anthony Gordon. It seems odd, Mark, that Newcastle will pay 60 million for Anthony Gordon when they could get Hakim Ziyech for 25 million.
Yes, I think if you just, if you're going down the Guardian sort of route of best players in the world and you were ranking those two, you'd
Anthony Gordon's at 3.
Ziyech would currently, particularly since he had a good World Cup, he'd be above Anthony Gordon. I think there's the homegrown element. Of course, teams do need a certain amount of homegrown players, which puts a premium on them. I think there would also be something in Eddie Howe that believes that Anthony Gordon's got the raw skills that could be coached and developed, and maybe at Everton that coaching and development hasn't gone on, and that there is a player in there. I mean, if you look at, I think there are a number of big teams that wanted Gordon in the summer, so that there is something that is there to like. And when I saw him last season for Everton, I felt he was really exciting and could go and develop into being an England player or around that England squad, and hasn't happened this season. But I do think that has more to do with Everton than it does maybe with the player. So 60 million would be a lot of money, but Newcastle have got a lot of money, so there is that.
Jonathan, we talked a bit about Arnaud Danjuma in terms of it being funny that Spurs had nicked him, but I don't know how good he is or how good he has been, how sensible a signing that is.
I think, it's an interesting signing because I assume that maybe Antonio Conte is planning to play him at wing-back because he's kind of a wide forward, and I don't really see where he kind of fits into that Spurs forward line. So, yeah, I don't know if it's maybe a squad option and Spurs just need a bit of beefing up. He was really good for a spell in Spain, and there was a lot of talk about people paying crazy amounts of money to sort of bring him back to England. And then I suppose, I don't know what's happened really in the last 2-3 months with him, but seems to have just allowed to leave in January without too much fuss about it. So I wouldn't have seen him going to Spurs. I don't really know exactly where he's going to fit into that team. As I've said, they're already kind of struggling to fit Richarlison in, which I found it a bit curious that Richarlison hasn't had more game time in the last sort of since the World Cup, I suppose. I know he's had a bit of an injury, but and it might be related to that. But with Son looking kind of quite,
sad. Looks sad.
Having a bit of a maybe sad, yeah, sad post World Cup hangover. I don't know if that's maybe affected, maybe influenced the decision. But he's a good player. I mean, Danjuma kind of he can get him behind. He's quick. He in some ways reminds me a little bit of Antony in a way, and in kind of his body shape and the way he kind of cuts inside and can kind of create from the wide areas. So I think it's an interesting signing, but I think he would have been more important to maybe other teams in the league. Like Everton, he would have been like a key man for them. Whereas with Spurs, I don't know if he'll be end up shunted at left wing back or something like that. So just going back to, was it Ross Barkley? I don't know. Has he ever had a night out in Newcastle? Because that could be a distraction as well, I'd say.
That's the best thing, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, it's like this, the bright lights of London is one of my favourite cliches. You clearly can't get a pint in Newcastle.
That's one of the best cities there is to go out partying, I think.
I would suspect, though, that if you're gadding about in Newcastle, it's a much smaller city than London, you're going to be spotted. And if you're taking the piss, it will probably get back to your man. It's a lot easier to hide in London.
There's a T-shirt. Can I ask you about, Mark, about, is it Pedro Perro from Sporting that Spurs are also trying to get? What if they get him, what are they getting?
So I think Pedro Porro is somebody that is a wing-back, more in the sense of a wing-back rather than, say, Emerson Royale, who is very much a right-back. I wouldn't say could play in a back four, for instance. You wouldn't want him at right-back. He gets down the wing and he puts crosses in, and he played very well in the two games against Tottenham in the Champions League for Sporting, particularly the game in London when he was just a threat throughout that entire 90 minutes. And I'm sure that would have played a part in Tottenham wanting to sign him. If they were to sign Pedro Porro, I think that would be around about £120 million spent by Tottenham on right back since losing Kyle Walker. So trying to replace him has been a costly exercise. I mean, Serge Aurier was doing Serge Aurier things at the City Ground on Wednesday. I don't think Matt Doherty's ever looked like being good enough for that position. Emerson Royale is a right back who he hasn't put in one assist, has he? I don't think from that position. Jed Spence was a club signing, as Conte called it, and clearly doesn't trust him. And I think to get the best out of a Conte system, you need people in those wing back positions that get forward and get on the end of crosses, because quite often the best Conte football is the left wing back to the right wing back, and that they're both in the box. And I think Pedro Porro would do that. I mean, and it will appease some Tottenham fans who have been, begging the club on social media to sign Pedro Porro, probably having seen, those two games against Spurs. But I mean, it probably wasn't a year ago that they were saying the same thing about Tarek Lamptey. He had to be the one that Tottenham signed to fill that crisis position. And it sounds like Sporting are trying to get Tarek Lamptey on loan to replace Pedro Porro. And the other question mark would be, like, he does well in a Conte system, presumably, but Conte might not be there in a couple of months. And then, if the next manager wants to play a back four, where would Pedro Porro fit into that? I'm not so sure.
Where would Poch put Pedro Porro? That's the question. Weston McKennie to Leeds looked like it might happen. A US enclave in Yorkshire. It'd be like the war, Barry, won't it? They'd all go to the tea dances, all the Americans there. And marry some good Yorkshire lasses.
Or maybe put a bun in the oven of some good Yorkshire lasses and then head off home.
Is Weston McKennie a good idea for Leeds, Jonathan?
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. They may as well throw Yunus Musa in there as well and have the entire USA midfield alongside Tyler Adams. But he's a decent player. I mean, McKennie is one that I've never really understood the hype, maybe. I know he obviously went to Juventus. I think he's a solid player. It's not someone that I would imagine that will come in and kind of set the Premier League alight, I don't think, necessarily. Not like Willy Nonto, for example, but he's kind of a solid performer. I'm not entirely sure of Weston McKennie's level, I'll be honest, in terms of what he would really bring to Leeds. Brings tenacity. He's kind of decent ball player. He's quite aggressive at times when he wants to be, and he can get in the box and make a late dart in. But I don't know if that's really what Leeds need. I don't know if they need more forward options, really, to be honest. And I know they've got Rutter now, who is a decent signing. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, McKennie will bring more steel in midfield and one for the tea rooms.
And they should get Gio Reyna as well, and then just keep him on the bench and then tell him he's going to be on the bench and then start another war. AC Milan apparently interesting. Christian Pulisic from Chelsea and Alan Saint-Maximin from Newcastle. Sort of interesting how Saint-Maximin sort of, I don't think he's been injured that much, but you sort of thought he might flourish and other players have taken his lead where he was sort of the one saving grace in that Steve Bruce Newcastle side. Matthew says, if Gareth Bale can play golf from scratch, what two outstanding things can the panel do that the British public should know? John Rahm saying that Gareth Bale, he said, you can't be so good at professional football and golf at the same time. It just doesn't seem fair. I do like the idea, Barry, of Gareth Bale winning the Ryder Cup for Europe. That is something I'm fully behind.
A lot of footballers are very good at golf. And I suppose they have a lot of spare time on their hands to play golf. And it's just one of those things. Some people are just very good at sports. I was staggeringly mediocre at best at a lot of various disciplines, but I was always envious of guys who were much, much, you know, seemed to be good at everything. But it's no surprise Gareth Bale is good at golf because he seems to play an awful lot of it.
He does. Well, good luck to him in whatever pro-am thing that he's doing. I presume he's not in a four ball with Donald Trump. Yes, Mark?
Yeah, well, I'd just like to add, I mean, I think I've mentioned this before, I'm a world-class poached egg cooker, so that would be number one. And the second thing that I would say I'm unrivaled at is knowing which bins to take out and which days that they go out, even when there are bank holidays, and it throws the rest of the street into chaos. I'm sort of confident.
So you're the first one to go out and everyone follows you.
Confidently stride out there and sort of lead the rest of the street.
Is this qualified, Mark? Is there like a world championships of
there may well be.
It's good to really celebrate the things you are good at, Mark. It's interesting because I've moved from where I lived in London, was there was a food market on that street. So every day was bin day. And now I have just bin day is Monday morning. So you've got to get the bins out on a Sunday night. And I find actually I find it quite sort of bleak because it's a real way of sort of realizing life is slipping away. You know, like it's just a moment ago. Oh, there's another week that's just gone, and it sort of makes everything feel much more finite. Whereas I was in this sort of dandy oblivion of every day was bin day for the last like 12 years. It was just, I didn't realize how liberating that was and how the only thing that was finite for me is football seasons. You know, that is how I dictate, you know, closer I'm getting to death. But now bin day, and that happens every week.
I have the same kind of relationship with my window cleaner insofar as he comes around the 23rd of every month, and each month he comes, and I don't really need my windows cleaned
once a month.
I know,
it's, that's amazing.
Well, I hadn't had them cleaned in about 12 years, and then a friend of a mate of mine said, oh, my mate's trying to get a window cleaning round. So I thought, oh yeah, I'll get him in. So now he comes every month. Now I clearly don't need my windows cleaned every month, but each time he comes, I if I'm at home, I hear the water dripping down and the scrapes. Yeah. So I go out and chat to him, and it's now more like a monthly therapy session. And I just get my windows cleaned as a, you know, that's an added bonus.
It's not John Robbins, is it? Is John Robbins cleaning your windows? Okay.
Each time I go out, I realise how little I've achieved in the previous 4 weeks.
How much are you paying a month for your window? No one has their windows cleaned more than once a quarter, surely.
Well, I have mine cleaned once a month and it costs me 20 quid a pop.
Oh, that's not bad at all. You know, I think you're
it takes him about 15 minutes. At least five of which is spent chatting and not cleaning windows.
Neil says, on the subject of that Darvill player who scored the goal and then had to go off and do an emergency plumbing job. Neil says, I think you're forgetting the British winter. I would imagine a plumbing call out in Scotland at this time of year would be for a boiler breakdown, leaving people with no heat in January. Not a problem for you in your tropical paradise. You've forgotten your roots, man. Well, I'll tell you something, Neil. My tropical paradise was broken into last night. And if the person who nicked my car and then blew $84 at McDonald's in South Melbourne on my company credit card is a listener to the pod, can I have the car back, please? I'll pay for the McDonald's. Thank you. Matthew says, finally, a few episodes back, Max discussed a listener who draws a bath and listens to the pod and kept reminding Nadim Onuaha of The Listener in the bath. I have one that is stranger. I had a vasectomy today, which is considered a procedure and not surgery here in the United States. Since I wouldn't be asleep under general anesthesia, I asked if I could use an earbud to listen to some music. I didn't really want to hear anything. So while the urologist performed the procedure, I listened to Max and the panel discuss how awful Everton are. So thanks for the distraction, as it was much better hearing the pod than any noises while they cut and cauterized my bits. It made a vast deferens in the experience. Hey. Very good. Healing is going as expected. Lots of ice and acetaminophen, which I presume is a drug. Matt Tsai in California. Well done to you, Matt, and congratulations on your procedure. And if anyone else is listening to this while having a vasectomy, I think this is the second vasectomy, to my knowledge.
It's definitely not the first.
It's definitely not the first.
I think we've had quite a few. Yeah,
presumably it's not the same person who's had one that didn't work and is now having it done for the second time. But look, we'll take all vasectomies that we can. And that'll do for today. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove with Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.